I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about, as contemporary an issue as it can be, the contemporary state of the presidential race. And I am joined, delighted and honored to be joined by our guest, Henry Olson. Those of our listeners probably know Henry's work well. Those of you who don't, he's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He is one of the foremost experts on American politics, electoral politics, and the political parties themselves. He has a person of deep insight, deep historical and philosophical insight that he combines with a remarkable understanding of the contemporary state of the political races. It's going to be a great conversation. Henry, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for what a plug. Thank you. I want to meet that person you just described.
All right. The contemporary state of the presidential election. Now, both political parties have held their conventions. Then the Democrats ended up nominating someone they didn't expect to nominate just a couple of months ago. What's your take of the current state of the situation now that the Democratic convention is over?
Well, you know, obviously the Democratic convention garnered the sort of fawning, positive press that they have become accustomed to. The question is going to be, will that move people? What we know going into the convention is that Kamala Harris had pulled into the lead. We know that Donald Trump, even though he's doing better in terms of having people like him than he's ever done before, remains an unpopular person. And so going into the convention, Kamala Harris had a favorability rating of roughly 49%, and he had a favorability rating of a little over 45%. So that translates that we would have expected, since polls show 98 to 99% of the people have a favorable opinion of somebody end up voting for them, we would expect that to be a 3.5 to 4 point Harris lead nationally. And that's, in fact, what the polls were showing. The question for the Democrats is going to be, is this convention going to move the needle? And if 10 days from now, we're talking about Harris still being roughly 50-50 in favorability and still roughly having a 3.5 and a 4 point lead, the answer is no, it didn't move the needle. And we will now have seen her high point. And that's where all serious analytical eyes will be watching. Does she move up to that 51, 52% that seems to be the ceiling for a Democratic presidential candidate in the Trump era, or does she remain painfully short of that? If she remains short of that, that is extremely good news for Trump because he then gets 10 weeks to start hitting back.
If she has gained some momentum, with whom has she gained it?
Largely the people who did not like Trump, but did not like Biden as well. That what we saw was, even as Biden's favorability rating was, or job approval rating was somewhere around 40 to 42, he was doing better than that in the polls prior to the debate disaster, and was only behind by about a point or so. Now that is bad for a Democrat because you need to not only win the popular vote to win the Electoral College, you need to win it by a couple of points, given the disparity in electoral coalitions that the candidates have. But it was, imaginable. After the debate, Biden dropped back by about 3 points, but it didn't really go to Trump. It went to Bobby Kennedy Jr., which was an indication that these are people who don't like Biden, but were sucking up to it because they didn't like Trump. And then when they decided they couldn't vote for Biden, or were uncertain whether they could vote for Biden, they hung off on voting for Trump. Trump did not make the sale to these people. These are the people who have come back to Harris, plus some people who had been in the third party realm, not willing to make a choice. They've decided that right now Harris looks a lot better to them, and they always knew they didn't like Trump. And so that's where we are, is that she has, at the moment, convinced the anti-Trump, 95% of the anti-Trump majority, that she is their vehicle to get what they want, which is denying Donald Trump another term in the White House. The question is, first of all, can she get 100% of that? That's why the difference between 49 and 51 is really big for the Democrats. And secondly, whether she can or can't, can she hold on to it? And these are the known unknowns of the campaign.
I think it was Will Rogers, at least apocryphally, who once said, I don't belong to any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. The Democratic Party, even in the convention, all parties, as you, of course, you and our listeners know, are oftentimes uneasy combinations of coalitions that don't always get to agree on things, but are held together by some kind of common interest or some kind of common opponent. The Democratic Party, and you're looking at the convention, did it display to you any fissures that will be important for the election?
No. But then again, what you have to understand is that this is the convention, is that conventions today are paid infomercials for the nominee. If you see divisions at a convention, that is an indication of serious problems within the coalition. You know, we all know that every party has warring factions that may agree on more than they disagree, but their disagreements are real. But you did not see that on display, and I wouldn't expect to. You know, these are the no one gets on the delegate floor without being incredibly loyal to some faction of the Democratic Party. They know what their job is in the infomercial. They're the crowd that cheers loudly. Republican delegates know it. Democratic delegates know it. All the scripts, all the speeches these days are scripted and approved. You're never going to have a moment. Unless somebody just wants to burn their bridges and can actually speak without a teleprompter, which seems to be a vanishing skill among American politicians. You wouldn't expect Ron Popeil's magic knife to break down on the paid infomercial. You should not expect Kamala's magic adventure part night three to break down in front of you either.
It seemed like the Republican convention showed that Trump and the Trump forces in the Republican Party are fully in command of the party. And it seems like the Democratic convention showed that Kamala Harris and sort of the progressive with her choice of the vice presidential nominee, the progressives are in full charge of the Democratic Party. Is that impression correct?
Well, it depends what you mean by in charge. For the Republicans, I think it is quite clear that the party's control is centralized in Trump and his inner clique, that there will be, once you need congressional approval, power centers outside of that that need to be dealt with. But within sending a party message, this is a Trump personalist party from start to finish. The Democrats, on the other hand, remain a coalition. So I think what it shows is that in order to be viable in the Democratic Party, you have to be at least progressive light. And that is what her selection of Tim Walz showed, was that she could have created a rift, not a major one, but, you know, a rift within the Democratic Party by choosing Mark Kelly or Josh Shapiro. But what she chose was the person who had the least number of enemies in the room, Tim Walz. And that just shows that progressives have to be appeased to maintain unity in the Democratic Party. And so what you will expect from any Democrat is that eternal dance between the center and the progressive left. The great Democratic challenge is that what most progressives want is not what most Americans in the center want. The problem is for the Republicans that most Americans in the center also don't want Donald Trump the person, and that creates the challenge between the immovable force and the irresistible object.
Some Democrats didn't show to the convention, some prominent ones. People like John Tester, who's running in for the Senate in Montana, they don't want to be too publicly connected to the progressives who are now the presidential and vice presidential nominee. Do you think that ticket is going to have an effect on some of the close Senate races?
Yeah, what we know is that in the modern era, meaning the last decade or so, is that it is very rare when a candidate wins a state that their party's presidential candidate loses. The only exception to that rule is Susan Collins in Maine, which is a tiny state, and she got close to 15 to 20% of the people who voted for Joe Biden to vote for her. That's the challenge John Tester has, and I don't think he's going to make it. You already see Tim Sheehy ahead in a couple polls. The last time there was a contested Senate race, Democrats were all high on the governor of Montana, Steve Bullock. He was ahead in some polls. He was running even others. He lost by 10 points because in the end, even somebody with a known moderate record who had won statewide before in this partisan age was not going to convince a whole lot of Trump supporters to cross lines. So what the ticket shows is that this is a Democratic ticket. And a Democratic ticket this day is going to be between center, left, and left, which means it's not going to get a whole lot of people who voted for Donald Trump 4 years ago. So Sherrod Brown in Ohio is running in a state that Trump will win by somewhere between 6 and 10 points, maybe 11 points, depending on how well he comes back from where he is right now. Can he convince 13% of Trump voters to vote for him? He's done it before, but that's going to be really hard, particularly when he gets no help from the top of the ticket that has crossover appeal. For all you hear in the media about Tim Walz this or Kamala talking about the middle class, this is not shown so far to have any sort of pull on people who voted for Donald Trump 4 years ago. The best they seem to be able to hope for is recombining the Biden coalition, which got 51.5% of the vote. And that means that Ohio is going to go for Trump. And that challenge for Sherrod Brown is very difficult. It means, given what we know about Latinos, that Nevada, which was 2 points for Biden, even if she wins with 3 or 4 point lead nationally, Jackie Rosen in Nevada may be in trouble. It probably, it means that the Senate races are going to hew very closely to the national ticket, and the national ticket is not going to be giving them extra voters that they can poach.
So for the next 10 weeks, what do we have to expect in the race for as far as president goes, as far as the Senate goes, and as far as the House goes? Can we start with the presidential race? What's it going to look like? What's it going to sound like?
It's going to sound very negative because that's what each side needs to do. What the Biden 51.5% coalition is united by nothing except a dislike of Donald Trump. So what you should expect is what you've been seeing, which is vacuous platitudes on policy that won't offend people in the center, but sound good to people across the political spectrum. Avoidance of hard stands that can make people move off of that, and a focus on who do you trust, me or Trump. That's what unites the 51.5% that voted for Biden. So what Trump has to do is say, well, first of all, rally the 45 to 47% that are in the tank for him so that he doesn't lose that. That's when you're focusing on the 2% of the vote you need, you can't expect the 46%, can't alienate the 46% that you've got. And then I would expect what he's going to do is say, this is not a new face. Or put another way, it's a new face on an old problem. And the old problem is the Biden-Harris administration. And what he needs to do is pull her favorables down. As I said, if you have a favorable impression of somebody, you're 98 to 99% likely to vote for them. We know that Donald Trump is not really capable of increasing his favorability rating all that much. He's already kind of at a high point. If he can get it up to 47, that's great for him. He should think about how to do that. But again, he's 10 years in the game, 9 years in the game. He hasn't come close to that. So if you can get Harris from 49 to 50 favorability down to 46 or 47, that means you've got a fighting chance. It means that the margin of error is almost none, and given the for Harris, and that means given the mismatch between electoral votes and Democratic votes, that Democrats will win large majorities in California and New York, but if they lose nationally, that gain that could if they lose 2 points nationally, that moves them from like a 1 point lead in Pennsylvania to a 1 point deficit. So you want to get her down to 47, and ideally, if you're Trump, you want to stay where you are, move up a little bit. If Trump goes into the early voting period that matters, which is to say the people who vote, or the overwhelming number of people who vote early, will vote after Columbus Day. If you go on Columbus Day and Harris's favorability is at 46 and yours or 47 and yours are at 46, you have a very good chance of becoming president of the United States.
Are there any events, either domestically or foreign events, that could scramble that calculus?
Well, they're all, that's the problem with life, is that events get in the way. It's not pure theory. Of course there are. You know, everyone's talking about how we're going to get a rate cut from the Fed, but we don't know what investors are thinking. We don't know what the next unemployment report is going to bring. And the fact is, even if we got a rate cut from the Fed, that would not matter in terms of the experiences of average people. It would take too long to diffuse its way through the economy for it to matter. And if you're in a tightening labor market and worried about your job, as many people are who are not college educated or in the government financial sector, then that's going to matter. Any sort of sudden downturn will matter. In Russians breaking through the Ukrainian line, you know, we're talking about now the Ukrainian offensive into Kursk. Well, what happens if the Russians actually break through the line and suddenly they do what they haven't done since the early days of the war, you know, start racing through the gap with armored units? Well, that's going to be really bad for the Biden-Harris administration. You know, what happens if Iran decides that they're going to launch some sort of a massive retaliation on or around the Jewish High Holy Days that are coming up? You know, that's a massive problem. There's a lot of ways you can see events going badly for the Biden-Harris team, very few ways that you can see events going positively. You know, the flip side being that it's always good for an incumbent to deal with an international crisis and appear to have successfully resolved it. Let's not forget that the Cuban Missile Crisis was worked out 2 weeks before the 1962 midterms.
Right, right, exactly. Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
What about your thoughts? You've given some already on particular Senate races, but your suggestion, if I'm understanding, sort of reading between the lines, is Harris could win the presidency, the Democrats could win the presidency, but lose the Senate.
I think that's an almost near certainty, is that the Republicans have 49 seats. There is no serious expectation that they will lose any. You know, Democrats are saying, oh, Colin Allred in Texas is behind by only 2 points. Trust me, you know, Colin Allred is not going to beat Ted Cruz in a year where Donald Trump does not implode. you know, that Texas will remain 8 to 11 points in the Trump camp, and there's no way that Ted Cruz loses 20% of Trump voters to Colin Allred. So what that means is Republicans need to gain two seats. They will gain the seat in West Virginia that Joe Manchin is retiring, and Jim Justice, the Republican nominee, will win in a walkover. And then all they need is one other seat. And as I said, I think that Montana is very, you know, 90% likely to go for the Republicans. That when you have a challenger who's already leading in polls in August before the ramp up of Republican advertising really begins, that's a pretty good place to be. So 51 is control. It's not given the maps what you'd like as a Republican. What you'd like is to be able to pick up Nevada. You'd like to be able to pick up at least one of the Midwestern trio. You would love it if Carrie Lake or Larry Hogan can, for different reasons, you know, Hogan being more popular than her party, his party, Kate Lake being less popular than her party, you know, would be able to go against type and bring a seat home that is not currently expected to flip. But you know, I would say near certainty of a 51 seat Republican majority in the Senate. And the closer Trump gets, the greater likely in the national polls, the greater likelihood that he'll be able to pull off victories in these swing states, almost all of which have competitive Senate races. And if Trump were to win the presidency, if Trump were to lose the popular vote by less than a percentage point, he would probably win in Arizona by a couple of points, win Nevada by a couple of points, win at least one of the Midwestern states by one or more points, Pennsylvania being the best likelihood of that. And that means that they should pick up at least one or two of those Senate seats, too. So I think between 51 and 53 Republican seats is where the smart money should be right now.
And what about the House? I've heard some of our observers and analysts say the House could go the opposite direction.
Well, you know, the question there is primarily New York and California, that when you take a look at why the Republicans hold the House, they hold the House because they have a lot of seats that Biden carried by double digits in the New York metropolitan area or in Southern or Central California. These are two different birds, though. On the one hand, in California, people look at the Biden numbers and say, how can Republicans be holding these seats? But the fact is, throughout the Trump era, Republicans below Trump consistently do much better. And I'm not talking about, I'm talking about the state assembly level, the state Senate level, the state offices level, and the congressional level. So when you take a look at these seats that they hold that Biden won by 10, 12 points or so, Republican candidates for governor win these seats. And did in 2018, and they do in 2022. So you look at this and say, these are much better ground for Republicans to be playing on in sense of holding the seats that Democrats are pushing against and a couple of pickup opportunities in this region as well. But then you get to the New York metropolitan area. The New York metropolitan area, you saw massive swings against the Democratic Party in 2022. Lee Zeldin, the Republican candidate for governor, carried every seat that the Republicans picked up in the House, even though Biden had carried them by as much as 14 points. And you have mixed evidence in the polls. Some polls show Trump doing much, much more like Zeldin, who lost statewide by 5. Others show him doing better than he did in 2020, but still not as close to Zeldin. And that's going to be the big question, is how do these voters vote? And this is also one place where the Israeli conflict can matter a lot, which is that a number of these seats have significant number of Jewish voters. And if Jewish voters are much more likely to vote for Republicans, even if they're not majority Republicans, just instead of going 3-1 for the Democrats, they go 60-40 for the Democrats or 55-45 for the Democrats. That could save a couple of these seats. The Republicans have their, I always forget whether it's they have 222 or 223 notionally going into the race. Redistricting and expected losses pretty much are a wash, that the Democrats should pick up 3 seats from intradecadal redistricting. Republicans will pick up 3, so that'll be a wash. And then the Democrats have to win a couple of the, you know, at least five of these seats that Republicans hold that Biden carried. And Republicans have a couple of seats that Trump carried. Democrats hold five seats that Trump carried. They have, they're making a full court press in all five of them. You know, if Republicans win two of those seats, and that is huge as far as being able to hold on to the House. But as it stands now, we should expect, if nothing changes between now and the election, we should expect the Harris-Trump numbers to look very much like the Biden-Trump numbers. We should expect Republicans to lose a few of the seats that they hold that that Biden and Harris will have carried. We should expect, though, at least one or maybe two of the Trump seats to flip. And that means control of the House would be a coin flip. If Trump, however, closes the gap, and it looks like Trump will, if Trump wins the popular vote, there's no way that Harris wins the election or that the Democrats control Congress. But let's say, you know, Trump loses the popular vote by two, Harris narrowly wins the Electoral College, but all these margins are narrow. I'd say there's a better than 50% chance in that scenario that Republicans have the narrowest of narrowest edges, but, you know, 219 to 216 is still a majority.
Right. A lot of these, this conversation and a lot of analysts' observations and predictions, of course, are based on polling. And our listeners are always interested, Henry, and it's something I know that you've thought a lot about, the state of polling.
Mm-hmm. Well, people who want to know that should subscribe to my podcast, Beyond the Polls. It's a weekly podcast where we do go beyond the polls in a lot of way, but I do have pollsters who come on, and gosh, I've had like six who've come on, who, and I always ask about the various questions about the state of polling. The TLDR summary of the state of polling is that the theory of polling rests on the ability to get a valid random sample of the thing that you are sampling. That's no longer possible because people don't respond to telephone calls, which was the gold standard of doing it in an even way. And no pollster wants to go back to the days where, which was very expensive and slow, of going door to door. So what pollsters have managed to do is use a different, a series of different types of techniques to approximate a random sample. And they tend to do a very good job of it on average. Different pollsters use different techniques. You can argue some do it a little better than others. But if you know who the decent pollsters are and you take an average between them, you will get something that is pretty good in a general election setting. Primaries are always difficult to poll because it's always difficult to know who's going to turn out in an uncertain way. And there are fewer demographic measures that you can use to approximate a random sample. There are many more that are accurate statistically in a general election sample. But then you get to the thing is that no poll is without a margin of error. If you're using approximations and you're off in a very important category very slightly, that can produce a different result. For example, if you are a Republican, you're 95% likely to vote for the Republican candidate. And if you're a Democrat, you're 95% likely to vote for a Democratic candidate. Get that ratio off by 1 point, and you've missed the margin by 1 point in either direction. And I think one of the problems pollsters have known they have is that there seems to be a slightly more pronounced effect on Trump supporters not to respond to conventional polls. And it's not a huge effect, but if you're talking about a race where 1 or 2 points matter, that matters. So generally, you should trust the polls, but you should also know what the polls are giving you, know what the weaknesses are. So if they're saying somebody's up by four, they could be up. You know, the normal theory would say, well, they could be up by, you know, anywhere between 1 and 7, you know, that's, or 0 and 8, you know, every single poll has a plus minus of about 4 points. You know, the averages should give you greater confidence, but, you know, it could still be that if they're saying If you're going into the election and the average of polls in a state says that candidate X is up by two, you should expect anything between the other person winning narrowly and that candidate winning by four. And if you understand that, you understand what the polls are telling you.
Yeah, that's a very important reminder. Your mention of the Trump, the old shy Tory problem, as it's called.
Right.
How much validity do you really think there's 1 to 2 points that of Trump that is not support that's not being represented in the polls?
No,
or are we past that now?
I'm not sure. I think that's one of the great unknowns. It wouldn't surprise me if you have a slight underrepresentation of Trump support in the polling average. Again, any particular poll may not get to it because of their particular methodology, but in the polling average, I think we're pretty good about that. The way in which Trump overperformed the polling average was in 2020 was about 2.5 points nationally. A lot of that was Latinos. You know, is that none of the polls, state or national, really picked up the Latino surge. And that was a different problem. You know, they had been correcting for the, you know, the white blue collar voter. And suddenly they realized that there was this Latino level of support that didn't seem to be picked up. But in the swing states, the polling error tended to be against Trump, but it tended not to be huge. Tended to be a point, 2 points. I looked at this a couple of weeks ago. So I think a good rule of thumb might be to say, take what the polling average says and figure that Trump will be, if the margin says Harris plus three, figure the real margin is Harris plus two. Don't be robotic about it. Just understand that don't be surprised if it's off by a point or so in Democratic favor. And there's nothing pollsters can do about it. You keep hoping that they'll reach perfection, but perfection is not reachable on this earth.
I guess that's why we hold the vote, right?
Well, yeah, that's the other thing is people actually do change their minds. One of the reasons my 2016 election prediction was pretty close to right on as far as the popular vote was I anticipated this, which none of the analysts did. I said, look, we can know 33 to 40% of these third party candidates are not going to go for these people. And we can know the direction that they're going. And in my memo, which is still online, you can see the work that I did and see the math. But we can know these things. But again, most analysts don't. So they say, you know, Gary Johnson's going to get 5.5% of the vote because that's what the polls tell us. And, you know, there was this huge thing that everyone wants to forget about now. But Slate Magazine had the great data guru from the Obama campaign whose model was predicting what the actual, as votes were being cast, they were updating the notional vote, the percentage in each of the states. And I said on Twitter that day, Sasha's going to be right if Gary Johnson gets 5% of the vote. The problem is Barry Johnson's not going to get 5% of the vote, and that's knowable. Someone who's wedded to the polls won't know it because they won't take into account human behavior.
And maybe it's an unfair question, but our listeners are always interested to know, especially from a person like you who's been such a careful analyst, what surprise could happen? What kind of, and I guess by definition of the word surprise, we don't know.
Right. But, that's the thing is I was asked this.
Let me ask you this. What would surprise you?
I say, well, I don't know because I'd be surprised.
Henry, what surprise are you looking for?
Yeah, well, this is what Donald Rumsfeld called the known unknowns. You know, what am I looking for? I'm looking for a bad debate, whether it's Kamala Harris being unable to speak coherently and anything but platitudes without a teleprompter, or it's Donald Trump having a characteristically mean or grouchy night. You know, we've seen both of these. So I'm looking on the debates how that goes. There's the things I mentioned earlier in the podcast. You know, we know that economic data will be coming out, and you know, we don't know. Will the stock market look good? Will there be this sudden, whether it's profit taking or something happens in the world that we have a 20% correction in the market and it's badly timed from political perspective, we know that could happen. We don't know. what will happen. We know that there are three hot flashpoints in the world, the Middle East, the conflict, the simmering but quiet conflict over Taiwan, and the Ukraine war. You know, we know any of these could heat up, but we don't know that they will or how it will. You know, 2 months ago, no one would have said we'd be talking about a Ukrainian offensive that seemed in Russian territory. So that's why we know that these things matter, but we don't know how it's going to turn out. I don't think at this point we're going to find anything about Donald Trump's background that's going to influence voters. We could find something about Kamala Harris's background that will influence voters. But again, that's a known unknown. I'm not saying there is such a thing or that we will find it. I'm just saying, if you ask me what sort of surprise could we have, but within the ambit of known possibilities, heck, Joe Biden could have a stroke and Kamala Harris could be the incumbent. Do I think it'll happen? No. Do I know that it could happen?
Well, this is a fascinating look into the messy business of self-government.
That's the thing, is that you're going to talk about between 150 and 165 million votes that are cast and counted. And I say that because there are always votes that are cast that aren't counted, that there's an error rate. There are people who will vote for some races, but they will skip others. There will be people who will skip the presidency because they don't want to make the choice, but they will be casting votes. But for the presidency, there will be 150 and 165 million votes cast. We know that it'll, barring one of these things changing the race dramatically, it will be a close race. Any of these things could matter. And you just have to keep your eye on the ball and be willing to live with uncertainty. That's one of the things that I try and do as an analyst, which is, anyone who knows me know I have rooting interests, but I don't do my job if I let my rooting interests unduly influence my analysis. When you go in and see a doctor, you don't want a doctor who will say, there's something bad on this screen, but I think you're living a good life, you'll be okay. No, you want the doctor to kind of tell it to you straight. And the fact is, I don't know what's going to happen. I try and create a range of probabilities, kind of like a quant does on Wall Street. I don't do it high tech, I do it low tech up here. But keep a range of possibilities open, be willing to live with uncertainty, and then see what develops, and be willing to change your mind as things happen. I didn't think 3 weeks ago that Kamala Harris would be able to fully surmount her record as vice president in public favorability ratings, but it's clear that she has at this moment. So you have to say, okay, this happened.
Remind our listeners again of your podcast if they want to subscribe to that.
Yeah, it's called Beyond the Polls. It comes out at the end of every week, either Thursdays or early Fridays. This week's edition, the Thursdays or early Fridays, you can find it. It's produced by Ricochet, but you can find it on Apple or Spotify or any of the normal platforms. And it's a 45-minute to an hour show. I have one guest. I have an ad of the week, where I deconstruct a 30-second campaign ad and explain to you why it's saying, everything about it, which is, who are they talking to? It may not be you, but usually isn't, because you're usually, very few people are in the target voter stream in any given elective district. They have these shots, why they have these words. Everything in a 30-second ad is calculated. And if it's not, it doesn't make it onto my ad of the week because it's a bad ad. I have what's called the rant, where I just go off for 5 to 10 minutes about a political topic and do a extemporaneous disquisition.
Well, what a fascinating, illuminating, interesting conversation. As always, Henry Olson, Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.